And so to begin, I was conceived by mistake, or a hot June day, or more probably night, in 1929 in New York. And 9 months later, I was born in London, in the London suburb of Hampstead, on the 20th of century, February 1930. It was there that I spent my first 5 years. My mother and I lived in a flat quite close to Hampstead Heath, famous from the paintings of Constable, and now a haunt of homosexuals cruising for sex for casual partners. But in those days, a thoroughly respectable place. My earliest memory dates to when I was 3 and of being lost on the heath. Some kindly person found me wandering alone and took me to the police station, where in due course I was collected by my mother. This was perhaps an early instance of my propensity to strike out in new directions, which has been an aspiding characteristic. The child is father to the man. Well, it's quite amusing, although I do say it myself. Me age 19. Me and Tatty Van Hannon. My father. Me and my son. Where am I?
Can you tell me what makes you the dissident psychologist?
Well, I disagree with the what you might call the politically correct position on numerous issues, in particular on race differences in intelligence, where I've documented quite large race differences in intelligence, ranging from the most intelligent people, who are the Ashkenazi Jews, followed by the Northeast Asians from China and Korea and Japan, then the Europeans, followed by the North Africans and South Asians, and then by the Native American Indians, and then by the Sub-Saharan Africans, whose I reckon their IQ is an average of 70, and they're therefore about 30 points below the European IQ, and finally by the Australian Aborigines. And I reckon these are largely genetic differences. So this is quite a controversial position, of course, and not all that many people are willing to endorse it publicly. Though some are, so that's one of my dissident positions. And then secondly, on sex differences, the consensus view is that there's no sex differences in intelligence, but I've come to the conclusion that although there is no sex difference in intelligence up to the age of about 16, but from 16 onwards, males begin to become slightly more intelligent than females, and this advantage increases into the early 20s. And even up to the age of about 23, at which age males have a 3 IQ advantage over females. And this is one of the factors, though not by any means the only factor, but one of the factors I've contended that explain why there are many more males who achieve outstanding contributions to society in virtually all walks of life than do females. But then I heard also that the genetic quality of the populations in economically developed countries is declining, has declined for the last century or so, because more intelligent people have been having fewer children than less intelligent people. So perhaps those are among, on contemporary issues, my major dissidents and dispositions. I think of myself as a conservative. I'm not a party member, but I certainly think of myself as a conservative. And it's really, that's just a different part of my life, you know, from being a scientist. Well, I think on a number of issues, the science is really, as it were, aligned with the conservative position. You know that intelligence is largely inherited, personality characteristics are substantially inherited. All personality characteristics that have been identified and measured have a substantial heritability, about 50% heritability. Inherited heritability is much higher, of course, about 80%. And I think these are really conservative positions, because they mean that there's a limitation in what you can do. People are largely, you know, have the intelligence they're born with. There's not a lot you can do about that. So, which is a conservative position. So, I see the two as really reinforcing one another. I was born out of wedlock in 1930. My mother was a person of rather average intelligence, but her parents were both intelligent. They both had first-class degrees in biology from Imperial College. I think my mother must have had some kind of, maybe she had a recessed gene which impaired her IQ a bit, or maybe she had a birth injury. So she was a person of rather average intelligence, but my father was a fellow of the Royal Society and quite a distinguished geneticist in his day. His specialism was the genetics of cotton. He had quite a varied career. He had a gift for annoying people, and he was fired from a position he had in the West Indies, where he did most of his work on cotton in the West Indies, and later in Peru. After he was fired, he sued them for wrongful dismissal at the old Bailey. Which he won, but so he was out of a job for about a year or so, was rather financially embarrassed at the time. So it was very costly suing people at the Old Bailey, of course. But the people, the Peruvians, who had a big cotton industry, needed someone to turn the genetic quality of their crops around. And so they wrote to him saying, "Would you like to come out and do this job for us?" So he did, and he spent about 10 years in Peru. And then he ended up as a professor of botany at the University of Manchester. So he was very clever. And I didn't, because he was abroad, of course, during my adolescence, I didn't meet him till I was 16. And then we used to meet, from time to time. When I went up to Cambridge, he would visit Cambridge every now and again for meetings, and we'd have dinner together. So we remained on good terms until he died. As I say, he had a gift for annoying people, which I've inherited. I don't think his IQ was horrifically high. As a matter of fact, I think my mother's side had higher IQ. As I said, both my grandparents got first at Imperial College. My father, well, he was moderately intelligent. He was born and brought up in North Yorkshire, went to school at Scarborough Grammar School, from which he got an award to King's College London to do sciences, but he couldn't do the chemistry, chemistry at degree level is quite mathematical, and he couldn't do that very well, so he switched into geology, which doesn't require any mathematics, of course. He actually graduated in geology. And he got a second in geology. And he got his first job as a school teacher in the West Indies, in the Danish colony, as it was then, of Saint Croix. It was obviously quite a small community in the Danish West Indies and in the West Indies generally. But he got taken up by some geneticist who was doing genetical work on various crops, including cotton, who took him on as a research assistant. So he got on, that was how he began doing research in genetics, but he was very well motivated. Of course, to be a high achiever, you have to have very strong motivation as well as a high IQ. And I would characterize him as being a moderately high IQ, but he was very, very well motivated. So he turned out a number of papers in genetics over the next few years, i.e. from the age of about, 21 to 25, and submitted them to London University for a Doctor of Science, which he was awarded. So my maternal grandfather, William George Freeman, although he was, I think, cleverer than my father, he wasn't very well motivated. He wrote a few papers. He ended up as director of agriculture for Trinidad. So he did quite well, and he published a bit of did a bit of genetical work, published a bit, but he kind of did what was required of him, and he preferred to spend his evenings playing bridge. Well, a characteristic which I've inherited, but. While my father would spend his evenings going over his research papers and writing up articles, my grandfather would be playing bridge. My mother was a keen communist, and which sounds rather a dumb thing to be, but it wasn't so dumb in the mid early 1940s. Capitalism had a bad reputation. There'd been the Great Recession from 1929 onward, mass unemployment. My mother was working in New York in her early 20s, and she'd seen people lying on benches who couldn't get anywhere to live. And so capitalism seemed to be in trouble. And then with the Russians defeating the Germans, communism seemed to be doing well. Quite a number of intellectuals were communists. The Webbs, two of them, Beatrice and Sidney, who'd been to Russia and said, "We've seen the future and it works." So there were quite a lot of quite sensible people who were communists in those days. And one that we knew through my mother, through being a communist, was the professor of physics at Bristol University, who was called Powell. In fact, I think he was a Nobel Prize winner. And he was a communist too. I knew him partly through my mother's connection. He had a daughter about my age. So I was quite impressed that the professor of physics and Nobel Prize officer was a communist. So as I say, it wasn't such a dumb thing to be in those days as it seems as we look back on it today. Well, I was 9 when the war broke out. I well remember Chamberlain's announcement on the radio, in which on I think it was September 3rd, 1939, in which he said, "We are now at war with Germany." And I was old enough to think that this was very bad news. So people were quite frightened. I was living in London at the time, Croydon to be precise. And we thought we might be bombed the next day, and we all issued with gas masks in case the Germans dropped gas on us. So my mother had friends in the Lake District in Ambleside, which is a very nice large village at the head of Lake Windermere. So she asked if I could go and stay with them as an evacuee, and they agreed. So up I went to stay with these people in Ambleside. And they were more affluent than my mother. We lived in a quite very modest little house in Croydon. They had a large market garden, and I remember the house had two staircases, and they had a maid who wore a black dress and a white pinafore, that sort of thing. And they had three sons, one of whom was my age. I think he was the middle one. But after a few weeks, they found I was too much for them. And they sent me to lodge with the maid, whose father was a labourer in a cottage in the village. So I experienced the notorious English class system when I was 9. First of all, this rather posher, more affluent family than my own. Then this labourer's family, rather less so. And I remember I went to the local council school, because it was called, of course. And I remember that every Sunday morning we used to go to the local cinema that were called the Flicks. They were called the Flicks. And you could sit, I think you sat in the front row. It was threepence a seat. In the second row, it was sixpence. And there were a lot of, in the second row behind us, there were girls from the local private school in their posh uniforms. So this was another experience of the English class system. And I was conscious of being a class below these posh girls sitting behind me. So it was quite an education in the English class system when I was 9 years old. Well, then I stayed there for a few years. And the likelihood of an invasion by Germany had now passed. We won the battle for Britain, of course, in 1940, and the Germans had invaded Russia in 1942 when I was 12. So I well remember this, and I remember thinking this is very good news. I knew that Napoleon had invaded Russia, and it was not a very good idea to invade Russia. And that is how it turned out, of course, when the Germans were defeated at Stalingrad a year or two later. So anyhow, it was obvious that the Germans were not going to invade us, and so I came down to Bristol and enrolled in the Bristol Grammar School. The people I found most impressive when at that time, we're going back 70 years or so now, when I was an undergraduate, was the London School, founded initially, I suppose, by Francis Galton and the people he endowed, the professorships he endowed at University College in London, starting with Carl Pearson, the professor of eugenics, and then by Sir Cyril Burt, and Hans Eysenck was a pupil there, of course, and Cattell worked there for a while. And I found these people much more sympathetic to my way of thinking than the people that were taught to me at Cambridge. At that time, Britain was doing very poorly economically. Although we'd won the war, we lost the peace, as it was said, as we were taken over. We were economically by Germany and by Japan. And I became interested in what psychological factors might be involved in economic development. And I became interested in the concept of achievement motivation, which was coined by a Harvard psychologist called McClelland, who wrote a book called The Achieving Society, which was quite a stimulating book. And I began thinking about that and developed an achievement motivation questionnaire, and wrote an article for the Times, which was published under the title, Would Dick Whittington Achieve in Britain? Would Dick Whittington succeed in Britain today? It came out in 1967, which I published my conclusions, which was that he wouldn't, because the achievement motivation was low here. This attracted quite a lot of attention, and in particular from the director of the Institute for Economic Affairs, a man called Ralph Harris, which had been set up as a free market think tank in the mid-1950s. So he invited me to the Institute of Economic Affairs and asked me to write for them, which I did. So I became, as I say, interested in the contribution of psychological factors to economic development, which became one of my major interests, and on which I later published one or two books with my Finnish colleague, Tatu van Hannen. Well, I'd always been interested in what is called differential psychology, which is the psychology of individual differences, which consisted partly of individual differences in personality and partly of differences in intelligence. And although I'd worked on personality, I'd lectured on this, and I kept up with the differences in intelligence. I was quite well informed about that, although I hadn't actually published it. Well, when I moved to Dublin, the brief at this Economic and Social Research Institute, which is a kind of sister body to the National Institute for Economic and Social Research in London, and the brief was to carry out research of economic and social interest to Ireland, in Ireland. So Ireland at that time was doing quite poorly economically in comparison with Britain and with other countries in Northern and Central Europe. So that was the main, main thing I began thinking about and reading research on it. And it wasn't very long before I noticed a study that found that the Irish IQ was quite low, significantly lower than that in Britain, about 94 or so. So that set me thinking that, because of course I knew it was very common knowledge that IQ was a determinant of earnings and success in life generally. And it seemed extremely likely that the same could be true of nations, being merely a collection of individuals, and that therefore that one of the reasons that the Irish economy was rather poor was that the IQ was low. Well, this was a bit of a troubling discovery, of course. But I had a research assistant called Ian Hart, so I thought I'd get him to check it. He carried out a study in Dublin. He confirmed it. It was quite IQ was about 94. So I didn't quite know what to do with this. I mean, I didn't think they were very pleased to be told that their IQ was too low, and still less to be told they might be able to raise it by curtailing the fertility of the less intelligent and giving rewards for the more intelligent. You know, the classical eugenic prescriptions for raising, set out by Francis Galton, for raising the IQ of a population. So I decided, it would not really be possible to publish this while I was in Dublin. So but this is what set me thinking that it's quite likely that intelligence is one of the determinants of national differences in economic development, on which I subsequently wrote quite a lot. Hitherto it had been believed, particularly by economists, that all peoples had the same intelligence. But I just began collecting the literature on these, and in some cases even funding it. And I was able, over the next several decades, to collect IQs for pretty well all nations in the world. Well, the first interesting results I published were the IQs of the Japanese and Chinese in 1977, in which my conclusions were that both the Japanese and the Chinese were more intelligent than Europeans, which has been substantially confirmed. I teamed up with a Finnish political scientist called Tatu van Hannon, and we published our first book called IQ and the Wealth of Nations in 202, in which we argued that the IQ is a major determinant of the wealth of nations. So of course, the problem of why nations are some richer than others has been one of the major problems in economics since Adam Smith wrote his famous book in 1776 called The Wealth of Nations, or an inquiry into the wealth of nations. And this was our answer to this, you know, the answer we proposed to this question, that the IQ of the populations is a major determinant of the wealth of nations. And it had a mixed series of reviews. Some liked it, some disliked it. We published two subsequent books on this together, producing more. As a result of my work on the IQ of nations, other people began to publish work on the IQs of nations, including, I must mention in particular, Heiner Rindemann in Germany, who's done quite a lot of work on that and come to essentially the same conclusion that I have come to. The best critique of my work. I don't think there'd been any substantive, successful critique. I think I've undoubtedly established the case. Someone called Hunt, Earl Hunt, now deceased, Earl Hunt criticised it. He's quite a distinguished psychologist. But in his last work, he conceded it was basically true. And I don't think anyone really has succeeded in destroying it. And quite a lot of people have confirmed it, including, as I say, most notably Heiner Rindemann, but some other people, a man called Jones, and an economist in George Mason University in the United States, and I think it's become very widely accepted today. It would be very remarkable, really, if it was otherwise. You know, I mean, IQ is a well-known determinant of income and success in individuals. Why wouldn't it be the same for nations? Well, not all the studies that I cite to support these are, you know, as good as they could have been, as you might say. There's probably no such thing as a perfect sample. There are approximate samples, but so, well, you have to do the best you can. You know, if you want to know what the IQ is, say, Indonesia, you have to say, you can't go out and test it there. You have to take the, you know, published studies, be they not necessarily as perfect as they might have been. the IQs of nations have a lot of effects on a number of social and economic outcomes, which I most recently reviewed in the book, summarized in the book I wrote by a young German friend of mine called David Becker, in our book, The Intelligence of Nations. And The Intelligence of Nations is, in this review, is shown to be a significant determinant of economic growth, economic per capita incomes, health, fertility, negatively, of course. High intelligent nations have low fertility.
Dysgenics is the genetic deterioration of a population. And the genetic deterioration is taking place and has been for the last century or so in respect of health, intelligence, and moral character. And one of these which has attracted most attention is the deterioration of intelligence. Now, the existence of dysgenics was first identified in the middle of the 19th century in France by a scholar named Morel, and in England by Francis Galton, who gave the name eugenics for a program to increase the genetic quality of the population. And so dysgenics is the opposite of eugenics. We have to infer it largely, though recently we can also measure it. We can infer it, I'm talking about the dysgenics of intelligence now, because intelligent people have been having fewer children than unintelligent people. From the closing decades of the 19th century, i.e. from about the 1880s and the 1890s. So because intelligence is largely inherited, obviously it follows, therefore, that if intelligent people are having fewer children than unintelligent people, the genetic quality of the population must be deteriorating. Well, this genetic deterioration was counteracted for many decades because of environmental improvements, principally in nutrition and possibly in education. So these counteracted the genetic deterioration, with the net effect that actually measured intelligence was increasing until about 20 years ago.
This is the Flynn fact.
About 20 years ago. But since then, intelligence has begun to decline in several countries, including Britain, and several of the Scandinavian countries, notably Sweden and Denmark. So to summarize, the dysgenics can now be identified as actually happening. There was the development of reliable contraception with the development of the condom in the mid-1870s. So it was inevitable that the intelligent people would use the condom more efficiently than unintelligent people. And so it can be said that once the condom was invented, dysgenics became inevitable, and so it was. Now, another dysgenic influence is through the immigration of less intelligent people into European countries. And this has been demonstrated particularly well by Emil Kierkegaard in Denmark. Well, we have studies of the second generation of non-European immigrants, and they also have lower intelligence than the European peoples. Sub-Saharan immigrants into Britain have an IQ of about 94, that is to say, six points below that of the indigenous population, whose IQ is 100, and they have slightly higher fertility than the indigenous British. For replacement fertility, women have to have two children. And everywhere in the economically developed world, women have fewer than few children. Women have fewer than two children, and sometimes a bit fewer, and in other cases, many times fewer. In Britain, it's what is called the total fertility rate of women is about 1.7, but this is fairly high by many international standards. In Germany, it's about 1.4. In Italy, it's about 1.3. These figures vary a bit from decade to decade, of course. But in some of the Northeast Asian peoples, namely those in Singapore and in South Korea, it's about one. Every woman is having, on average, one child. So, obviously, the population is declining in total numbers very considerably. Probably about 82, I suppose, because India has an average IQ of 82. And India is a functioning democracy. So I guess that is the answer. A lot of course, because there are about 1 billion Indians, there are a lot of clever people there, even though the average is around 82. There are caste differences in intelligence in India, and the Brahmins, the highest caste, do have a slightly higher IQ than the other castes, but it's not very large. As the intelligence declines, so the output of, or the production rather, of a great variety of things which is going to deteriorate. The output of the quality of science and inventions, artistic, literary creations, these will all inevitably deteriorate as the intelligence of the population deteriorates.
Do you think it's an existential threat?
It is an existential threat, yes, certainly.
Why aren't we doing anything about it? Why is nobody talking about it, if that's the case?
Well, people become very sensitive to any suggestion that some people are better than others. And it's, of course, implicit in the whole notion of dysgenics that some people, namely intelligent people, and also people with what might broadly be called strong moral character, strong work ethic, and that syndrome of characteristics, it's implicit that these qualities are better than those of low intelligence and weak moral character. And people have become very sensitive to talking about this. I noticed, for example, that the what was originally the Eugenic Society in Britain, as eugenics became unfashionable, as it were, after World War II, it changed its name to the Galton Institute. And but because Galton was favoured the idea of eugenics, it's now changed its name to something new. It calls itself now the Adelphi Institute, because it wants to be, the trustees have told us that the it's called itself the Adelphi Genetics Forum. This is the new name for the Galton Institute, and the trustees have told us that they want to dissociate themselves from any idea of dysgenics. And Galton's name is associated with dysgenics, so that's why they've erased the name of Galton from the Institute. Galton, who was much concerned, of course, with this problem, did suggest solutions. But they were not very convincing. He suggested, for instance, that local communities should identify parents who had an intelligent child and pay them bursaries to have more children. Well, it's obviously not going to be very effective. Solutions have also been proposed negatively, as it were, i.e. by sterilizing people of low intelligence to prevent them having children, and therefore reducing the numbers of unintelligent children who'd be born. And this was quite widely introduced, first of all in the United States, in various states, initially in 1913, and by the late 1920s, about half the states in the United States had introduced sterilization measures for those with low intelligence. And several continental European countries introduced similar legislation, notably in Sweden and in Germany. This legislation was never introduced in Britain. But this legislation would have had some effect, but very, very minimal practical effect. So none of those measures have really any potential, any significant potential. The most likely solution to the problem is by introducing a procedure known as embryo selection, which has a potential for the future, which has not been realized at present. Embryo selection means that a woman would have a number of embryos fertilized in vitro, say, a dozen. And this can be done already, and is being done, of course. And these embryos would be assessed for their genetic qualities, including for those of intelligence, and possibly for other qualities as well. This is a potential solution in the future, which will no doubt become practicable in due course. And then the ones that were considered most desirable would be implanted. Well, if all this works, and it's very likely it will work, it would have quite considerable advantageous effects in raising the genetic quality of the population and therefore counteracting the disgenic processes. This is quite widely prohibited throughout Europe and in North America. But as the procedure becomes practicable, it will undoubtedly be feasible, it will be permitted in somewhere in the world, some Caribbean island or somewhere in the world will allow this, and couples will go to it. I mean, the facility will be available for couples to go to one of these clinics wherever it's established, and produce their half a dozen or so embryos, and they'll have the one that they consider the best implanted. So I think this is unstoppable, this will eventually, initially, this will be used by a small elite, as many new technologies are, like the motor car and the telephone and so forth. If initially they're used by a small elite, but eventually, with time, more and more people use them. So I think there's a very promising future when all this comes to pass. Well, difficult to predict, of course, when all this will actually become possible. But I would think the answer is yes. The dysgenic processes are only happening quite slowly. The population IQs are only deteriorating by about one or two IQ points a generation. So it'll be, 25 years or so. It'll be a long time before it has really much practical significance. So I would think, firstly, certain that this technology will come online before any serious damage is done. I don't think we have a responsibility for this. I think it's academics' jobs just to research and publish the truth as they see it. And as I say, that's the end of it. Well, I can't think of anything offhand. Some people do, of course, argue that people shouldn't research, let alone publish work on race differences in intelligence. But I think this needs to be known, partly as an academic truth, but partly, of course, because it does have practical consequences regarding the kind of immigrants that are allowed into European countries. Yes. Well, I think Charles was quite right to publish the book. As I say, with regard to my own works, I think the truth needs to be set out. Of course, as you suggest, these are just group differences. They don't predict all in. There's a wide variety of a wide range of intelligence within each group. So it doesn't necessarily mean, of course, that all blacks are less intelligent than all whites. There is overlap. But as I say, I agree with, I think Charles is quite right to publish his book.
Do you think it's the truth is intrinsically good?
Is
I intrinsically good. Truth is intrinsically good, or do you think it's
Yes.
that there are also positive outcomes from proliferating the truth?
I think the truth needs to be known. I was very disappointed by the review of it in the Times Literary Supplement. I don't know whether you saw that. It was very adversely reviewed and even endorsed. The adverse review was even endorsed by the editor, someone called Martin Ivans, who, as far as I know, has no expertise in this subject at all. And I was rather surprised that he decided to do that. I didn't really think it was his place to do so. By all means, publish the review if you want to, you know. But I don't think it was his place as the editor to endorse it. Martin Ivans was the son of Ivan, of Michael Ivans, who was a conservative. I don't know whether you know this, but he organized a campaign in about 1950 when the Labour government had nationalized a number of industries, and they would decided next to nationalize the sugar industry, which seems a somewhat curious choice. But there was a campaign which Michael Ivans organized, we were shown sort of Mr. Sugar, a lump of sugar with a little head and two arms and two spindly legs, weeping and saying, "Please don't nationalize me." His father was a a keen anti-nationalizer. But whether his son has inherited this, I don't know. Perhaps not, in view of his comment in his editorial condemning Charles Murray's recent book. Well, I understand your motivation, but I do think you'd be wiser to keep a low profile until you get a reasonably well remunerated and position with tenure for which you can't be fired. That would be my advice, but I do appreciate it must be hard to keep quiet. Well, of course, it means acquiring a lot of knowledge in the particular area. And also a critical sense of not taking the knowledge that the received knowledge, entirely for granted. Or keeping an open mind about whether these assertions are really true. Well, does it mean any more than having a high IQ? I suppose not, really. But there are many people who have high IQs who don't use their IQs very productively, or even productively at all. For a variety of reasons, partly because they don't have the motivation, or the education and the knowledge through which you giftedness can be used. So I would say it's probably only a minority of people who really use their giftedness to the full extent that of its potential. I hope that the contributions I've made will be accepted and come to be generally accepted. And I think they've, well, I think they probably will be, because as our ancestors in medieval Europe said, magna est veritas et praevalebit, which translated means great is the truth and it will prevail.
Do you think about death? Do you think about death?
Yes, I do. Well, naturally, when you're 92, you think about death, which could come at any moment, of course. But on the other hand, some 92-year-olds go on to 100 or even more. So it could come unpredictably at any time.
But you're not afraid?
No. You get kind of used to the idea, you know.
Do you believe there's anything on the other side?
No. I don't believe in the afterlife, no.
Do you have any advice to young people?
Well, I do, I suppose, yes. You should get yourself an education. And use your abilities to their greatest extent. So I doubt whether my advice would be taken. Are we done now? Yeah. I want to see if I can find you some.
Yes, some books. Yes. Come upstairs, Ricky. I would love to. Yeah.
You want to pack up here first?
Yeah, I'll just stop this.